Hello, good evening, and welcome. This is Samuel Trapp. You are on Dam Radio, and you're listening to International Flavor. If you're listening at 9 p.m. on April the 28th, this show is live. JR has allowed me the privilege of having my show recorded at the night while people get used to the fact that I'm changing times. And it plays double. So it'll play again tomorrow on the 29th at 4 p.m. And I made an error last night. And so I wanted to cover a little bit of what I covered last night because I can actually play some of it tonight. I've, like I said, gave up on the simulcast of trying to do audio and video at the same time. But the time at 9 p.m. is much more convenient for me, and I kind of like it because there's nobody after, and I happen to go over, well, that's not going to be the end of the world, is it? And I can do what I would like. I wanted to do something a little bit different today. I'm always talking fairly serious, but first I wanted to let you know that if you're interested in calling in, the phone number is 940. I'm giving you my phone number. My phone number is 573-746-8020. Yeah, you can call in. I'd be happy to chat with you late at night. I don't sleep anyway. I have terrible sleep patterns, and it's not good for you. And I have never had good sleep patterns. You know, drove all my ex-wives crazy with my failure to sleep and staying up reading all night and staying up and I don't know what, playing video games when I was a younger man and doing those kind of things. That reminded me of something I found. I don't know if anyone even remembers these systems, but I found while cleaning out my garage and a box of crap that I haven't seen in forever, I found my Sega Dreamcast system and steering wheel, and it all still works just fine. And there's a game in there. I don't even remember the name of it. It's some sort of a driving game. And I forget what it's called, but I used to waste all kinds of time on that ridiculous game. But you know what? I don't have a memory capsule. You have to have a memory capsule to save the game. Otherwise, all you can do is play the game. You can never get anywhere. And, you know, what are you going to do? You know, leave it on all the time? That's nonsense. And then it'll surely shut off anyway, or there'll be a power thing, and then off you go. But I got onto Amazon looking for a memory cassette or whatever they called them, because these were made in, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s. And just the memory set, just a little memory chip, 2 gigabytes of memory or something, or some incredibly small amount of memory to save the game. And $48 or something like that. I haven't sprung for it yet. It's like, man, it'd be fun to try to use it again. It'd be, but as soon as I bought that 45, something else would go haywire on it because it's an old system. And I got to looking on them online, and those games, if they still work, are worth a decent amount of money. I don't know. Maybe I'll sell them. That'd be kind of funny. But I have a garage full of crap that I've been sorting through trying to get rid of, and that was part of it. But that's not what I wanted to talk about today. I just sidetracked myself, as I always do, and this show is International Flavor. And I've always wanted to, and I've never done it, but I've always made notes to myself to do it. I kind of like to experiment in the kitchen. As my ex-wives and kids can also tell you, I kind of enjoyed cooking and still do, and experimenting and making different things. I'm no master chef by any stretch, but I have no problem experimenting and playing with certain types of food. Well, I like to try international things, and so I want to walk you through something completely different today. We're going to go into a real international flavor. And I might do two things. I make a few Russian versions of food. And if you're interested in these, there's a good way to make them, and I can tell you a little bit about them. Well, I may have told you the story of when I was in the military as a young man, and I was stationed at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. And it's a year-long school. Pardon me, drinking my tea. And it's a year-long school and 8 hours a day learning Russian. And the very first day of this school, my teacher's name was Mr. Tenenbaum, and he was an old Jewish guy that had come over. And I was one of the older kids in the class. I was 20. Everybody else was 18, you know, and I had just turned 20 when I joined the military. I tried to go to college, pay for it myself, working two jobs, you know, failing miserably, you know, trying to go to school at night and work, and it was nonsense, and I was just failing miserably. And then at any rate, I tried that for 2 years. My grades were crap, and I ended up joining the military, got that job, and you know, enjoyed it, kind of. I was actually surprised myself how much I actually liked it, because I remember thinking, you know, geez, the people who join the military are those who don't really have any choice. If I'd approached it differently, and I did after I got in, but if I'd have thought about it differently, it's a great means to an end, because you got a lot of educational opportunities and things like that, and including, for me, learning Russian, which has served me fairly well later in life. And so, at any rate, I went to the school, and I didn't get there until by the time basic training was over, which I started basic training in the summer, Fort Dix, New Jersey, and whatever it was, 12 weeks, something like that, 3 months, maybe it's 10 weeks, I don't remember. But you go to the basic training that everybody goes to. And then for our job service, I was a 98 Golf Russian, which means I was a signals intelligence, meaning radio, signals intelligence voice interceptor, and I would intercept Russian language broadcasts, intercept Russian language traffic on the radio. And in wartime, I would be collecting Russian language tank traffic, plane traffic, you know, whatever, any of their military traffic. I'd be listening to that and telling people what it was. And I became fairly well versed in what they call direction finding. At the time, you know, it was a fairly new, and I know it wasn't that, I mean, more widespread, I guess it was. It was becoming where you could pinpoint where somebody was located by listening to their radio. And now, it's nothing. Every, you know, people know exactly where you are, pinpointed within a foot on the earth. Well, we learned all about errors of elliptical errors. You'd had to have three helicopters or three trucks tied together, each one direction finding a signal, and then where those three lines crossed, you could hazard a guess that that's where the signal came from. So you had to have one mile apart. Well, each one was a mile from the other, so over a period of 2 miles, one in the center, one on either end, you'd have three things. If you had five, you could tie it together with five different direction finders, but three was the typical, and you could pinpoint to where they are within this error of probability of whatever it happened to be. And so if the elliptical error was pretty big, you know, you're guessing, but sometimes the elliptical error was very small, yet very clear, crisp listening post, and you got a clear signal from each of the three places. And when we later transferred it into helicopters, and I was on a helicopter team doing that, Then we were very accurate, and you could pinpoint exactly where they were, and then you call in the artillery, and they take out the grid square, and those guys are gone, and that's that. And now they don't have to take out the whole grid square. They take out one little point. And anyway, that's what I was learning. And I don't know why I told you that whole stupid story, but another Samism. But when I was first getting into, so you go to basic training, learn everything that everybody in the army learns, you know, how to carry a weapon, how to run, how to, you know, find your, you know, tell the difference between your head and your ass, you know. It's used to have a drill sergeant say, you know, you couldn't tell your head from your ass with two hands and a map. And I heard that several times in my life from other people. It's you know, it's entertaining, some of the stuff that drill sergeants learned how to say. I was always called hero. From hero, you get on down there and you push until I'm tired, you know, that kind of thing. It was a lot of fun being in the military, actually. And I took it with a grain of hell. I liked doing push-ups. I liked doing all that stuff. At any rate, the courses were tied such that first you did your basic training. Then, for my skill set, you had to learn the language first. There's no sense to send you to learn how to do direction finding if you're going to end up just in the regular infantry and not able to listen to any of the voices that were trying to direction find. So you learn the language first, and the language course for Russian was 1 year long. And so I joined the Army and started in July. So July, August, and part of September, I was in basic training in Fort Dix, New Jersey. Then I was sent to Monterey, California, to the Defense Language Institute, where I was located for 1 year. And in that school, you learn Russian, 8 hours a day. Speak in Russian. 200 people in a class, basically 20 classes of 10 students each, and about at that time a 40% pass rate. 60% of the people ended up in the infantry or wherever, washed out, as you call it, of the school, and they couldn't make it. Well, we had a very good instructor, and in our class there were 10 of us, and only one person washed out of that class. 9 of us graduated, and we ended up being, I was in the top 5. I don't remember my exact number, but I was in the top 5 and just picked it up very well. You know, don't ask me to fix your car, but I picked up the language part pretty well. And but I remember being in that school, and this excellent teacher that we had who taught us his system and said, After today, I will never speak to you again in English. I will speak to you in the next couple hours, explain to you my system. After that, if you can't say it in Russian, then it's not important enough to say. So figure out how to say it in Russian and ask me that question. You know, if you have something to say, say it in Russian. And, you know, I'm going to demand that you say things in Russian every day, and here's my system, and blah, blah, blah. So it was pretty cool. And he got us very much into Russian culture, very much into Russian film and Russian movies, Russian music, and how to learn a language. It was kind of like a total immersion class, and you would... And I loved it. It was challenging to me, and I really liked it. And it was a lot of fun. Well, the first time I ever ate a blini, or a blinchiki, depends on what you want to say, is if you want to take something and, for example, if there's a guy named Ivan, and Ivan, if you want to have Ivan, and Ivan, you want to call him Little Ivan, could be Ivanchik, Sam, Samuel. They have that name, but it's not as prevalent, of course. And I would be Samchik, little, you know, small Sam, you know, whatever. And if you're having a blini is a cross between a crepe and a pancake. So the French have the crepes, Americans have the pancakes, and the Russians have the blini, or blinchiki. And blinchik, you know how crepes are a little thin, and some, you know, takes a special hand to make them. Well, a Russian blini is similar, more similar to a crepe than a pancake. And I hate pancakes. They are just, I don't know, it's like eating a brick, you know, to me. I don't like them. And they're thick. I don't like sweet, you know, I don't like syrup. I don't like, it's, to me, that was just eating one big rock, you know, even if they were reasonably tasty, you know, and thinner and maybe more. And they're just heavy. And, you know, I never, ever liked them, which was, and they're so easy to make, you know, that you could just, and had I liked them, it would have been, you know, much better on my mother, you know. But, you know, as a little bit of a cereal guy, but I've never been a big sweets eater. So the first time I had a blini, I didn't know what it was. And it was at Easter time in, you know, Passover time in this Russian school. So I had been in school for about 6 months. We were learning how, and we were getting pretty good at saying what we intended in Russian. And one of the instructors, man, I wish I could remember her name, because she always sang when she talked. I always liked it when women talk, la 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 la, and they sing when they speak in Russian. It's just and the men are, you know, and they got all these, they're far more gruff, and they never open their mouths when they speak, so they're not very clear. But I remember being invited to a feast of Passover, or whether it was required and they were making it on this weekend of Easter or what, I truly don't remember. And but it was, they were putting together, a lot of the teachers, and all the teachers were former Russian, and I mean with 20 just in our class, with 20 teachers just in our class, was, you know, a wide variety of people. And so we when we graduated, we had almost 100 graduate. I think we're in the 90s that actually graduated of the 200 that started. And so you had 90 of us and 20 teachers, and then whatever teachers' aides and stuff like that. And so when you put on a little shindig, the shindig was pretty cool, right? And so here we are, it's Easter, it's a religious holiday, and they are going to create for us, I don't know, salmon, la sauce is salmon. They were going to make blinchiki, we were going to eat caviar, and we were going to make these blinchiki. And I liked the blinchiki, and it was the first time I had ever had a blini. And I liked it. They're far more milky and thin than they are floury and fat. And if you see some of the recipes online, if you look at the ones online, I found one that I'll go through here with you in just a minute, that I found one online that I particularly like, and I'll tell you how I make them. But mine is basically the same recipe the way I make them. And I make them, I don't know, every month maybe I'll make a batch of these, and you know, it doesn't take long. It's really something you can quickly whip together, and I'll walk you through this great recipe online, and very close to what I do, but not quite the same, and there's some good ideas on it. I used to have a book, and I can't find the damn thing. I'm sure it's in one of these damn boxes in the garage, that was a Russian cookbook. And, you know, it's a cookbook. I found one of my cookbooks. It's called The Ship's Cook and Baker. I'm looking at this right now, and this book was printed out. This book, 1942 is when this book was printed out, and it's basically recipes for a ship's cook. And so this was how a ship's cook would learn how to cook, military and all that. And I've, you know, made a couple of things, and they're pretty basic and, you know, pretty easy to whip together. Obviously, if you're on a ship, you're not going to worry a whole lot about cuisine. You're just making some food for the men to eat. Excuse me again. So, at any rate, I want to go over this recipe that I made, or that I can tell you about, and it is pretty fantabulous. So let us begin at the beginning. And this one I stole. You can find it. It's and if it's, so, you can find this recipe for yourself and try it out. And I'll tell you certain differences that I make. And I haven't tried it exactly like this, but mine is pretty similar. And this website is called littlebroken.com. And it's a lady named Katya. And has a recipe for blini recipe, Russian pancakes. This was updated in December of 2022. Basically, traditional Russian blini are thin, pan-sized pancakes made from an unleavened batter, very similar to crepes. Crepes are slightly larger in size and thinner than Russian blini. And if you make these right, they're very tasty. You dust them with some powdered sugar. You put in some jam. In Russian, that's called varenya. And you can put in, it's very tasty. And I will read this entire article to you, because she has a she has several different recipes on here. And I like soup, too. And I've learned how to make some Russian soups. And but anyway, you will love these Russian pancakes. Growing up in Russia and having learned firsthand how to make Russian blini, I inherited this cherished recipe from my mother. It's a family secret passed down through generations, perfected by my mother over many years. Now, mine is very similar, and so I've perfected it over the same sort of amount of time, because, you know, I've ruined a good many batches of blini when I make them. If you're going to make them, it takes a little bit of a practiced hand to figure out how to do it, but now I can do it, and they're pretty damn good almost every time. Anyway, she says, I always eagerly anticipated the moments when she'd prepare these pancakes. And now, and they're not pancakes, so I don't like it when they say that. They're blini, period. And as a parent myself, I continue the tradition with my own children nearly every Saturday morning. So I was always big in cooking Saturdays and Sundays. Mostly Sundays, you know, because there was nothing else planned, and I liked a good breakfast. I always liked making omelets and just going to town. This fail-proof recipe for blini, composed of basic ingredients, has been tested countless times and is guaranteed to yield, I'll say near perfect, she says perfect, results if you follow her proven tips and tricks. And I'll give you a couple of my own. With its availability, store well as leftovers. Absolutely true. You can confidently prepare a large batch over the weekend and enjoy them for days to come. This will undoubtedly become your go-to recipe for delicious blini or blinchiki. And, what are blini, we say? Blini or blinchiki are thin, pan-sized Russian pancakes. They are much thinner and wider than American-style pancakes, but not as thin and wide as crepes. They are tasty and versatile, often served with sour cream and jam, or stuffed with a sweet or a savory filling. A lot of people put caviar in there. Today, I'm sharing a family favorite sweet blini recipe. These are lightly sweetened, soft, and delicate. We enjoy them with maple syrup, I don't, fresh fruit, yes, or a dollop of sour cream. I've learned to like that, actually, but I want a little bit of sweets in there, whether it's going to be some jam, jelly, and a little bit of sour cream with that. That's freaking tasty. So if you take your basic ingredients, so what you're going to do is you start, you're going to need milk, cane sugar, butter melted, baking soda, eggs, all-purpose flour, vanilla, light olive oil, and salt. So eggs you start with, milk whole or 2%. I actually use very low fat milk. I use cane sugar or honey. I don't do the honey. I don't like that. I've tried it, but I don't like it. Kosher salt, baking soda. I skipped a baking soda as well. Light olive oil or refined coconut oil. This helps them stay thin and cook well. Butter, all-purpose flour, vanilla extract. A lot of times I leave the butter out also. You need a 10-inch non-stick skillet or crepe pan and a flexible rubber turner. It makes flipping blini very easy. Now, I like to use a plug-in, I don't know what you call it, non-stick baking surface, you know, that you could put, people do eggs and sausage on there. I like a flat non-stick. I don't make mine as large as the whole pan. I make mine a little bit smaller. And so that's how I do. So here's how you start. In a large mixing bowl, whisk the eggs and add the milk. Now, I do this differently too. I whisk the eggs and then I add the sugar. And it's a small, so basically you put like a 3/4 cup to 1 cup of, I'm sorry, skip the milk. You put an, I half the recipes, so I don't want to make a ton of them. But even if you are making a bunch of them, it doesn't matter. Because it takes a little bit of experimentation to get them to the right consistency. So the first one, when you, I do one egg, but you can do two eggs, just whatever you're going to do, double it. I do one. And I do a teaspoonful of sugar with that. Sometimes I'll sprinkle in a little bit more for extra. And this, and I don't do the honey, but some people will. They'll take, and I do it, I put the egg and then the sugar, mix them together, and then put in the milk on top of that. And I mix those three ingredients. Then I'll add in the, I don't use salt. Sometimes I put in a little baking soda. It does help to keep them flat. And then I definitely put in some olive oil. And I replace the butter with the, I put a little bit of extra olive oil, but no butter. And then I whisk them all and combine them. And this lady says she just whisks in the flour. I do not. I sift in the flour. And so in the flour, you want to do about, if you're doing a cup of milk or 3/4 cup of milk with your one egg, that's, which is about what I do. It's between 3/4 and 1 cup that I put in there. And with one egg, the sugar, the olive oil, and a dash of vanilla gives it just a fantastic flavor that you put it in there. And I like them with the vanilla. And then you whisk these damn things and you get them all, you get that all very, very smooth. And then I don't whisk in the flour. I mean, I do, but I sift it in first to get rid of any potential lumps you might have. And so then, you know, you put that all together and you whisk it, or you whisk it until there is no lumps at all. Meanwhile, your hot pan, whatever you're doing, just under 300, between 275 and 300 is what you want that temperature on. And if it's a nonstick skillet, you know, that's fine. If you're using a plug-in surface, I like to put it on that. But they don't come as round and as clean as they would be in a 10-inch flat skillet. Because you can buy those little quarter-inch high flat skillets, you know, that are just perfect. The 10-inch, 12-inch, and you can make a 10-inch or a 12-inch blini by pouring about 1/4 cup in the middle and spreading them around to get it nice and thin. And just, you don't want to overdo it because you don't want them too thick. and they cook pretty quickly when you do this. And you know, you don't you want to make sure they brown a little bit, get a little crispy on the edges. They're very, very tasty that way. But the batter should, when you've done mixing up all the batter, no lumps. She says she puts the vanilla extract in last. I do not. I put the vanilla extract in before the flour. I don't know that it really matters, but the batter should feel fairly thick, not like pancakes. Pancakes are pretty damn thick, but this should be like a heavy cream, like if you're pouring a thing of heavy cream somewhere. And you'll see how it gets. Meanwhile, you're heating a 10-inch nonstick skillet or crepe pan over medium low heat. You want to spray it lightly with nonstick oil, or rub it with, you know, I take a stick of butter is what I do, and I just put a layer of butter on there before every one that I do. I put another deal, and you put just a quarter cup of the batter, or a little bit less, you know, a quarter cup, maybe a third, but you don't want to go higher than that. And you put it in the center of the pan and you swirl it around the whole pan to spread it evenly, to make sure that it gets spread evenly. You cook it for 45 seconds on either side. And then you use your little rubber spatula and it'll have a little bit of, what do they call it? Lacing on the side when you flip it. And then you take them off, and I put them out and put a paper towel over it and put a paper towel in between every one. You know, that gets rid of any excess of butter or oil that you've gotten on them. And then you either serve them hot. I don't like them hot. I want them at room temperature. I'll leave them sit for a bit. So I'll make the whole stack of them. And sometimes I'll even put them in the refrigerator and eat them the next day cold. They're very tasty that way. But I like them wrapped in their own paper towel and put in a large Ziploc or something, you know, a gallon size Ziploc. And you can eat them with syrup and fresh fruit. But some people eat them with cottage cheese. That's tasty. Some Greek yogurt, sour cream, jam, honey. I don't really like whipped cream. Can't stand it. Chocolate? Nope. Nutter butter. Or what do they call it? What is the name of that stuff? Nutella. Oh, Jesus. When I was over in Uzbekistan, they were all into the Nutella. As everywhere you went, you'd find these bottles of Nutella. And you're going, what in the world is up with this? How you store leftover blinchiki, you can, not with toppings. With toppings, you don't want them that way. But they'll last 2-3 days in the refrigerator, especially if you keep them covered. I put them in a Ziploc, but a lot of people don't because they get a little soggy, you know, if you do that. You can reheat them. You put them, you wrap them with foil or something, and you put them in the oven for 10-15 minutes. And or you can reheat them in the microwave for just a little bit. I put them in a paper towel if I do that. You can dust them with powdered sugar. You can do that, and with some fresh fruit. She has some tips here at the bottom. Cook the blini on medium heat and adjust as needed. If the heat is too high, the blini will burn around the edges before they are finished setting on top. If the heat is too low, they will stick to the surface. When you first pour the blini batter, it will be wet in the skillet, but gradually the edges will set and bubbles will form in the middle, just like they do in a regular pancake, and the blini will start to get dry. When no liquid batter is visible, it's time to flip. If you flip too early, the blini will bust. If you flip the blini, to flip the blini without breaking it, loosen the edges with a rubber spatula. Lift the edge with your finger as you glide the turner toward the center, and then flip it in one swift motion. I prefer to do it on a, I don't know what you call it, like I said, on a flat, whatever, flat surface. Anyway, those are blinchiki, and they're quite tasty. And I hope you if you try out this recipe, that will definitely work. Should put some notes down here on the bottom. Let's see if I agree with this. Make sure to use a neutral tasting oil, such as light olive oil or refined coconut oil. Refined coconut oil has no distinct coconut taste, but virgin or unrefined does. And then it's the same thing when you store them as leftovers. Do it without toppings. You know, you can do it without toppings the same. And she has a lot of comments down on the bottom. Thank you so much for the recipe. I like to eat them. Here's somebody telling her what to do. This is a recipe for blinchiki, not blini. Blini is a yeast-based dough. Blinchiki have no yeast. I don't know the difference. I've never heard that. But I don't really care. I just know what I wanted to treat. Blini are traditionally made from maslenitsa before the Russian Orthodox Lent. So Maslenitsa is that holiday that I got invited to. Somebody else says, make a perfect blini, almost foolproof. I agree. Thank you for this amazing recipe and the tricks and tips. I enjoy eating blini when I lived in Estonia and Latvia, and when I visited Russia. We had ours on mornay sauce, flavored with Gruyere, garlic, minced white onion, nutmeg, and dill. Oh, I like them with that, with some garlic and dill. Next time, we're going to put a little smoked salmon on top of that one. I don't really like smoked salmon. I'll take some cold salmon every once in a while and do that. But I'm not a big smoked flavor type of guy. Then we made homemade apple cider syrup with whipped topping and blackberries for the sweet ones. Heaven, heaven, heaven is what they say. And then a lot of people, a lot of good comments there. Oh my goodness, these were very tasty. Once we got the hang of making them, they look beautiful and taste amazing. And they're quick, and they're cheap, and they're just, you know, very good to eat. I like them. So I think if you would like to give it a try, it's a good recipe. I will tell you again, her website that she put it in was littlebroken.com. And she calls it the blini recipe, B-L-I-N-I, recipe for Russian pancakes, if you wish to follow it. And I like them, and as should you. Another thing I wanted to tell you about is, so there's these really cool things they make in Tatarstan called triugolniki. And triugolniki basically means triangle. The little triangles. And so they take these dough, and in the dough they put whatever the filling is. Sometimes they do a sweet filling, sometimes they do a meat-based filling, and then they put it in the middle, they pinch them all up to close them up, and then they cook them. They're also called ečpačmak, and ečpačmak are also quite tasty. And they're a Tatarstan food. And the ečpačmak is a very good. Maybe I'll give a recipe for those. But I'm not an expert on those. I haven't been able to perfect that one at all. And usually it comes with having a very good dough. The dough has to be just right. And I'm not an expert. One other thing I wanted to talk to you about was the Russians make a mean kotleti, and kotleti are basically, I suppose the best way to say it would either be it's a large flat meatball or a fat kind of hamburger, you know, not quite as big. They call them kotleti. And they can make them out of chicken. I don't really like them out of chicken. They usually do them out of a mix of ground pork and ground beef. And with the pork, you know how pork is kind of dry when you mix it. They put in the beef with it. Now, I have my own recipe that's kind of been Americanized over the years. And I bought some of these little tiny, well, they're not tiny, but single-serving pots. You can find them in Walmart. They're these little casserole dishes that are basically about a cup. And inside of each one, you can make your own little mini meatloaf. And so, you know, they're just like a little casserole dish, a little tiny one. And, you know, they're pretty cool. And I had something similar when we were in Morocco, and I wish I could remember what they're called. But in Morocco, they have these little clay dishes that are covered with this clay chimney looking thing, and I wish I could remember what it was called, but that's not the story today. These are Russian cutleti and Russian foods, and I've learned how to make some pretty good cutleti myself. And you I like onion, and so I like to chop up some onion in there. You mince it really small, or even grind it up in a blender. I mean, you want it pretty small. And I like garlic too when I mix these all up. And and you want to have, I've always been one of those guys that buys the lower fat content meat, and I don't really like pork, so I leave the pork out. And so I do more of a beef one, and I'll do like an 85% fat and mix it, because I like to add either crackers or most of the time I'll take some croutons and chop them up really small, or crush them or whatever really small, and mix them in with the meat when I make it to add some flavor. So you can buy the seasoned croutons, and that takes care of a lot of the seasoning, because I don't want to make them and I'd like them to be juicy. That's why I use the 85%, although arguably you could even do the 80% and buy the cheapest type, and you could chop up a lot of the what do you call them? Croutons. And mix them up. And there's all kinds of good flavors of croutons out there that you can find. And or make your own. A lot of people make their own. Or you can just use crackers. They're decent crackers you can do too. Crackers are very good. And sometimes they're easier to crush up. And sometimes you can do the saltine variety or the... I've never done it. I did a townhouse once, but I won't do it again. That was a bad plan. And... you can do little pita crackers, you know, whatever sort of boxed crackers you want to try, you know, that you could try something with a flavor that you like and use it as the base of the flavor for these cutleti. And you can make your own and put them in a pot. You can cover them with cheese. You can put some little mini meatloaf is what they end up being. But anyway, you can, those are different because that's more Americanized than anything, but they call them cutleti, and there's some good Russian recipes for that too. And those are pretty tasty, and you can make them with some small new potatoes or something that you boil, and you toast them, or you, I don't know, I like them a little bit of crispy on the edges, so you know, I cut them in half. And then make sure to bake them for a little bit after they've, you can either boil them for a while and then bake them for the last 10, 15 minutes to get them crispy on a higher heat. That's a very tasty way to do it. Then put some butter and some salt on there and make them really good. Anyway, that's got myself all worked up over food today, and spent more time on it than I intended to. The other day on Sunday, now we're going to switch topics, switch gears completely. I wanted to talk a little bit about and see if I could get some of the Telegram channels that I pay attention to in Russian. And here's Telegram for desktop. And you can get Telegram for Windows 64, which... I intend to use here and to log in. And you have to be able to use this with a VPN to get some of the news that I like to get. And there's plenty of it out here. I wanted to play a couple of these pieces for you. Fear of Russia could break apart NATO, according to the Financial Times. And I believe this one was in, well, it's written in English, you know, and I just want to, read it for you. The EU fears that Putin will attack the rest of Europe, which is completely nonsensical, by the way. While the U.S. warns a direct conflict with Russia could start World War III. If NATO can no longer agree on the threat it faces and how to deal with it, the whole alliance is at risk, according to the Financial Times. And a guy named Gideon Rockman. I read the article. The guy's, you know, dreaming a little bit. I wish this one was in English, and it's not, but I would like to play for you one of the videos that are coming out of a woman trying to keep her son from being dragged off by recruiters in Ukraine to take him off to the front. You know, there was one that was particularly troubling, and this I'm going to play for you, and this is unbelievable. I'll have to stop it a couple of times while it plays, but get this. There's an interview being done by a guy saying, if a child speaks Russian, if a child speaks Russian, take a rod and beat them in the ass so they this is Ukrainian guy, so they forever forget the Russian language. That is how you instill pride in their own language, said Ukrainian ex-Prime Minister Benyuk. Sounds very democratic, right? Free and European, right? Lunacy. Well, it won't let me see these without the VPN being installed to play it all, but it let me play this before, and I want to read what he's saying as you listen to him say it in Ukrainian. So he's being interviewed, and here's the interview.
Я дивлюся, що молоде покоління іде в загальний супротив, і я особисто не знаю, як мені говорити і боротися зі своїми тими.
This is Ukrainian, and so basically she says, my nephews and nieces, where are they? Come on. Ah, why can't I read the, it's not, I have to make the screen a bit larger and make sure that you can hear it all. Yeah, you can hear it. So basically, let's make sure that it's large enough for us to see it all. We're gonna go back to where he starts. And I personally don't know how to talk and fight with my, I gotta make sure to turn it down just a little bit so you don't hear it. This is very troubling what they are saying here. Well, she's asking a question. I'm not sure what to do with my nieces and nephews, she says. Because of what they are saying, but that was coming out too loud, so I'm going to turn it down some, because the goal is to read it for the whole thing. He goes, you take a rod, and this guy is former prime minister. He said, you take a rod. Yesterday was Sunday, a lazy Sunday. You take a rod and you hit them in the ass with it once, so that they forget forever that there is a Russian language, and thus to instill pride in the child for the language. Because when a child knows that it's a matter of pride, it will feel like a Ukrainian. It won't have questions about how to speak to their classmates and when they should switch to their language. And it won't feel like an outcast in his class or another. You need to be able to cultivate respect for your country, and everything is clear. If you have nephews like that, fight with them. Fight them. A sharp blow. The elders need to hit them on the head with a water bottle if they have that kind of intelligence. Can you believe that? So if they have that kind of intelligence that they will speak Russian instead of Ukrainian, you need to beat your kids over the head and use a rod and smack them with it, basically. This guy, don't let them speak Russian. No, we only speak Ukrainian. And that's what they're doing to this generation. Unbelievable. Un-freaking-believable. Let's see. Spain declared an emergency. Zelensky turns down Putin's ceasefire plan. Oh, here's a good one. A $60 million F-18 fell overboard and was lost at sea after the USS Truman dodges serious Houthi fire. The FA-18E was actively under tow in the hangar bay when the MOVE crew lost control of the aircraft, said the U.S. Navy. I mean, it just fell off the side of the boat. I'd like to be the guy in charge of that. Oh, geez, it fell off the side, sir. That's a month's pay. Most sinking charge in the military is 1 month of pay, so you don't need to worry too much about that. And sorry about that. You just lost a month's pay. Okay, so last night I wanted to play for you a little bit of the Lavrov speech. I like listening to this guy, and his English is pretty good. So we're going to begin again with this. And listen to a little bit, but we're going to get further into it. The entire interview is 45 minutes long, and it was about the 20-minute mark where it started getting... I mean, it was good the whole time anyway, but we followed a little bit of it last night, and we're going to go through some more of it tonight, and I will stop it and make my own little commentary along the way. Okay.
Correctly, you neither fear sanctions nor want them lifted.
Look, you quoted my statement.
And yes.
You quoted it right.
Let's get back to there. We're going to go back just a couple of minutes. Okay. To where he is.
Longer than...
Where is she with her latest question? Because she's a loony.
A bit longish, but it's difficult to explain otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I ask about the threat of sanctions or secondary tariffs, because you recently said in an interview, if you had to personally pick sides, you would keep the existing sanctions in place on Russia. You said you've restructured the economy to be self-sufficient, and there is a growing fear that, quote, cunning Americans will lift sanctions all of a sudden to flood our market with services and technologies. So if that's the case, why should the United States consider lifting sanctions at all?
Why do you ask me? You just quoted my statement, and this statement is clear for me and clear to all those who read it. If you have questions to the American side, how they treat the situation, it is not the right address to raise it with me.
So you want to keep sanctions in place? Is that really the Russian position?
I don't want to re-explain what I explained, I think, in quite clear manner.
He said. So basically, she keeps trying to pressure him into saying that, you want the sanctions lifted. And he keeps going, look, What is Trump doing in the United States? He is putting out, and he's been saying this for a while, and he gave a speech last week in Bald Eye Club or something like that. And at that summit, he said, well, frankly, all the sanctions have helped us focus our own economy, and we have become more or less independent. We produce everything that we need here, and Russian companies have stepped up to fill any potential void left by other countries that want to sanction us, including the United States. And he said something to the effect of, maybe it would be nice if they, you know, I'm afraid that if they take away sanctions, people are going to want to come in and go back to the way it was before, and it's not going to go back to the way it was before. So she keeps trying to twist it to say, oh gee, all you want to keep sanctions, like he's being a smartass, and he's not. She wants to act like he's being a smartass. So he goes, you just quoted me to myself. He quoted me to me, and you want to ask me the identical question that I responded to when I was asked this question in the first place?
And you quoted, I think, very close to the real content, yeah.
Right.
But it was a bit longer than normally you prefer. I know.
Well, back in February, though, one of your colleagues, Kirill Dmitriev, who runs the Sovereign Wealth Fund and has been active in the diplomacy with the United States, said something a bit different. That's why I'm asking for clarification, because he said there is the expectation that American companies would return to the Russian market in the second half of 2025.
Well, the president of Russia commented upon this situation. He said that we have nothing against American company, but those companies who decided to leave their business in Russia might find that their place has been occupied already by Russian or other foreign investors. And in this case, we would not make any decisions which would discriminate those who came to invest in Russia instead of Americans. If American companies would like to come to a place which is not yet occupied, if they want to propose a project, a new project, on top of the previous business ties, of course we will look into this, and if we find balance of our interests, I think it would be only natural to get into business together.
Well, what areas has the U.S. offered to lift sanctions on? Because it wouldn't be possible for many American companies to enter the Russian market right now under the existing sanctions.
It is up to them to decide.
So no offer has been made?
No. How can we offer something in a situation
when... The United States to Russia.
Well, the United States clearly tells us that they are interested in doing business together. We never reject business proposals provided they are based on the equal opportunities and the treatment of each other and lead to a balance of interest. Specific proposals which are being mentioned in the media, I cannot comment upon. This is not serious. We are not we are not acting like the people in Kyiv who talk to the world through the media, including talking to presidents of great countries.
So if I understand...
He made this point many times in this interview, and you might hear it again in a little bit, but he kept making this point that we are not the people who will let the media judge, you know, we'll use the media to negotiate. We are not that way. And as they get a little bit further in here, she says, but Trump is, you know, and he does make a comment on that, but he's going, we aren't in the habit of basically he's saying nobody's offered to take away the sanctions. If they do, we will probably be interested in listening to such a proposal. But so far, you know, that's not part of it. She's a, well, you said you didn't want the sanctions removed. He goes, yeah, you quoted me quite well on that. We're not gonna go create places for people who left us, you know, 3 years ago.
Understand you correctly, you neither fear sanctions nor want them lifted.
Look, you quoted my statement, and
yes,
you quoted it right. That's my position.
Okay. So when President Trump threatens new sanctions, that's not of concern.
You're asking this for the third time.
Yes.
This was a brief answer. This was a brief answer, by the way.
You are being brief on and direct on that part. I was asking on the sanctions for clarity and directness. Broadly speaking, when you look at what's happening in the battle space in Ukraine right now, analysts say about 18% of Ukrainian territory is under the control of Russian forces. U.S. intelligence says battlefield trends are in Russia's favor. So if that's the case, why should the U.S. believe Russia is serious about ending the war if everything is in your favor?
Well, we judge by the reaction of our American colleagues to what we tell them. And this is being done during negotiations. They're confidential, as any serious negotiation. And they know our position, and they, as I quoted Marco Rubio, he publicly said that they better understand the Russian position and the reasons for what is going on. And he said that nobody in Washington lifted a finger to do the same, to understand, to try to understand Russia during the Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
And this implies that the dialogue continues, that the dialogue is supported by the United States, and I reiterate that it is supported by the Russian Federation, and this dialogue continues.
So President Trump said he expects to meet soon with Vladimir.
See, I don't know what kind of question that was, because she kept saying that, you know, if you're winning, why would anyone think that you would want to cease fire? And frankly, that's a reasonably good question. And he's going, well, because now Marco Rubio has said that people want to understand what the root causes of the war were. If we could figure that out, maybe we could resolve this without killing people. But she goes on to this next point.
Vladimir Putin. What's an acceptable time and location? Why should they meet?
Look, the presidents are masters of their own destiny and of their own schedule. I heard President Trump say that he is planning to be somewhere mid-May, and that after that he would be suggesting some dates. I cannot add anything else.
Right. He said he was asked about meeting with Vladimir Putin specifically in Saudi Arabia, and he said most likely not. That's in mid-May, but shortly thereafter.
You said the same thing as I.
Right. So what are you planning?
He's really frustrated with this interviewer. She keeps on saying the exact same thing he says, and he's he's a good interviewer. He says what he means. Three or four times in this interview, he says, "You wanted me to be brief, and I can't answer these questions when, you know, just in a couple of words. And sorry, that wasn't really brief." And he keeps on pounding her with it, and she's not. I wonder if she doesn't understand. Sometimes they used a different word. I wonder if she fully understands what he's saying.
So we read the same newspapers and watch the same channels on TV.
Right, but I can't pick up the phone and call Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, like you can. What plans are you making for the two to meet?
Look, I hope your listeners understand very well that it is not ethical for a foreign minister to prejudge, to presume what presidents might or might not discuss.
But you think it would be good for the two leaders to meet soon? Do you expect
that's what
Envoy Witkoff is negotiating?
We're always in favor of meeting with people who are ready for a dialogue. President Putin repeated this thousands of times. And when we met in Riyadh, together with President Putin's foreign policy advisor Ushakov, with Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz, the American colleagues clearly stated that the U.S. policy is based firmly on U.S. national interests. They understand that the Russian policy led by President Putin is also based on Russian national interests, and that it is the responsibility of great powers to make sure that whenever those national interests do not coincide, and this is in most of the cases, this difference should not be allowed to degenerate into confrontation. And that's what dialogue is for. But they also added that when the national interests of two countries or of more countries coincide, it would be stupid to miss an opportunity to translate this coincidence into some material, mutually beneficial projects. And this is absolutely our position.
You know that President Trump is coming up on 100 days in office, and he has made clear his patience is wearing thin with the diplomacy here. Do you expect the U.S. and Russia to continue to talk after these potential peace talks fall apart? I mean, is the rebuilding of the relationship so significant now that you think it could withstand
Russia
the peace talks in Ukraine falling apart?
What kind of crappy question was that, by the way? Do you anticipate that the that you're going to still talk when these negotiations fall apart? Basically saying they're going to fall apart. So what is your position on talking afterward? And I like how he responds to this.
Russia is always available for a dialogue. So you have to address your question to the American side. Second, you prejudge the current process by saying that eventual collapse of the talks. We concentrate on doing business, not on thinking, you know, failures or victories about anything. Unless you concentrate on the facts, that's what we do, you cannot be serious about what you are doing.
Well, President Trump and Secretary Rubio said that the window was closing, that time is running out here. That's not my opinion. That's what they said.
Look,
I want to ask you a little.
No,
go ahead.
Wait a second. I just quoted Marco Rubio, who yesterday said about better understanding of the Russian position. So maybe you missed that.
Well, he also said a decision in days needed to be made. And that the U.S. has other things to focus on.
No, we understand. We understand the impatience. Because in American culture, you create expectations. And you ignite tension around those expectations. This does not help to do real politics. But in our case, as I said, we are always ready for dialogue, ready for negotiations. And we would not, begin by banking on a failure. This would be a characteristic of bad deal makers, inexperienced deal makers.
So if you listen to what he is saying, and this is what I've been saying for forever, when you listen to this guy, when you listen to Putin, they have set their goals, their requirements, what they anticipate is going to result from their special military operation in Ukraine. And if the U.S. is prepared to come along and discuss and talk about these root causes of why we're here, why we're where we are, then the potential to resolve the conflict exists. But this lady, all she wants to talk about, and all anybody in the Western media wants to talk about, is how Russia should capitulate because Donald Trump says it's time to end the war. And okay, fine. it's time to end the war if you understand that we have joint, this is what Lavrov is saying right here, if you understand that we have root cause analysis of why this war occurred, and we're not just going to stop because it's time to stop the war. We're going to stop when we have determined that the root cause of why this war is here now has been addressed. And until this is addressed, we're not going to stop just to give Ukraine time to rearm. I don't know how much more clear, how long have they been saying the exact same thing? How long have excellent people like Jeffrey Sachs and Douglas MacArthur and Scott Ritter and lowly Samuel Trapp been saying the same thing? My Alex Cristoforo on the Duran, he's a great guy to listen to. These are people that actually know what's going on, and you know, not the warmongers like Lindsey Graham, not the warmongers that want to continue having Ukrainians be slaughtered, or the Zelenskys of the world who just want to say Russia needs to capitulate. Russia is not going to capitulate. The capitulation should be done by Europe and most notably Ukraine. And I think we're getting closer and closer to that. I truly do.
Mm-hmm. Others in the Russian government have proposed that the U.S. and Russia could work together in the Arctic. Are there specific areas of discussion for cooperating right now?
You always want me to disclose things.
Well, this was a public statement.
Things which might be discussed by respective officials of Russia and the United States, by those who are responsible for trade, economic cooperation, investments, and so on and so forth. How do you expect a participant of negotiations which are still to reach some kind of specific understanding to disclose details in public? It is not serious.
I'm asking what you think the potential is.
I read President Trump's book, The Art to Make a Deal, and he doesn't advise to disclose information before it's time.
Respectfully, President Trump speaks quite a lot about the things he would like to do with Russia and opportunities to work together. I understand you don't want to. On the specific things President Trump has said in public, one of the things he brought up is that the U.S. could work with Ukraine to operate the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, which...
This is... I talked a little bit about this on the show this afternoon, about how the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant should be turned over to one of the alleged proposals on the table. And this is where Lavrov says it doesn't. This was never proposed from the American side to Russia. Now, it may have been discussed with Ukraine. Obviously, something was discussed with Ukraine last month because they talked about it back then. But it's not going to happen. It's pretty... Listen to how he responds to that about the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant,
which is in an area, you know, Zaporizhia. Russians control it, that area right now. Do you agree with President Trump's public statements that the best security would be for the U.S. and Ukraine to operate that together?
No, we never received such an offer. And if we do, we would explain that the power station, Zaporizhia power nuclear power station, is run by the Russian Federation state corporation called Rosatom. It is being under monitoring of the IAEA personnel permanently located on the site. And if not for the Ukrainian regular attempts to attack the station and to create a nuclear disaster for Europe and for Ukraine as well, the safety requirements are fully implemented, and it is in very good hands.
The power plant is in very good hands. In other words, even if they do make an offer to us to let the U.S. run the power plant, they can take a hike. That ain't going to happen.
So that's a no.
No, I don't think. I don't think any change is conceivable.
Okay, because that was in a public statement from the White House to the media.
We as I said, we did not receive any proposal which would be specific. So, you know, I understand that journalists have to speculate. We cannot speculate on something which is really not being mentioned during the negotiations.
Zaporizhzhia is not being negotiated right now.
Shall I say that for the third time? You wanted me to be brief. You wanted me to be brief.
But I heard you, but I just want to be abundantly clear, because that is also widely reported to be in the U.S. proposal currently on the table.
Why don't you ask me about President Trump's position on Crimea?
Here's where he goes. What? He heard what he said, yes? Oh, I mean, I'm sorry to repeat him, but he goes, why are you asking me what President Trump wanted to say about Crimea? Because, you know, nobody wants to talk about that, because nobody agrees that everybody thinks Trump should be beaten at the, you know, beaten with a whip for claiming that Russia gets to keep Crimea.
You liked what President Trump said about Crimea yesterday when he said it has been under Russian control since 2014?
It's not about liking or disliking. It's about the fact that he said the truth. And
So he said something specific you liked.
When Zelensky said that this is absolutely excluded because Crimea is part of Ukraine according to the Constitution, nobody in Europe or in the States, by the way, reminded him that apart from territorial issues, the Ukrainian Constitution guarantees, I quote, the free development, the use and protection of the Russian and other national minorities' language in Ukraine. And they guarantee the development of ethnic, cultural, language, and religious identity of all peoples and national minorities in Ukraine.
Now, see, the reason I played that last clip before, that I played for you, the former Ukrainian PM that said that you should beat children who want to use Russian, you know, in the school, and to make sure that you just beat them over the head, hit them with a rod, and force them to speak Ukrainian, is because here in the United States, Ukrainians even are saying no. But I've told you, I've run into girls here in freaking Home Depot that will not speak in Russian. If I say something to them in Russian, they won't do it. They will reply in Ukrainian. I go, I don't speak Ukrainian. They go, well, I won't speak Russian. So they've taught them to hate not only Russians, but all things Russian. So this is a mistake. What if in the schools in America we taught everybody to hate Spanish? To hate it, not to not speak it. Not anything, but to hate it and to beat your children if they were speaking in that language, to teach them what it would be. It's nonsensical. And what he's saying is, we all want to talk about constitutional rights and how Crimea is a constitutional part of Ukraine, but we don't want to talk about anything else constitutional. We don't want to talk about how the president isn't having elections. Anything that is constitutional is only limited to something called territorial integrity. And that this is, according to the Constitution, this is, well, what do you do about the people who have self-determination and have decided to join Russia, like Crimea, like Zaporizhzhia, like Kherson, like Lugansk and Donetsk? I think he's absolutely right here that at the UN and everywhere else, nobody wants to talk about constitutional issues.
This is also in the Constitution, but as I mentioned already, and you decided not to go deeper into this topic, nobody in the West even mentions human rights when they demand that Ukraine defeat Russia in the battlefield.
President Trump said Crimea is not even being discussed right now.
Yes, because this is a done deal.
You mean Russia occupies and controls and will not negotiate the future of Crimea? Is that
Russia,
what you're saying?
Russia do not negotiate its own territory.
Russia will not negotiate its own territory, meaning these places are part of Russia, and we're not going to negotiate that part. Good luck with that, basically.
And
President Trump understands this.
One specific thing that you do want in the public space. You said everything else that I've asked you about in the U.S. proposal is too sensitive to discuss. Is there any other part of the U.S. proposal that you do like?
No. I only commented what was said publicly. And I also said that normal negotiators, I emphasize this once again, normal negotiators do not negotiate through a microphone. They meet and they discuss, they listen to each other, they try to understand, they try to see where a balance of interest can be reached. And this is how our contacts with the American representatives are organized.
Respectfully, you've been in the top levels of Russian diplomacy for 30 years.
For how many?
For at least 30 years. I mean, you've been in very key diplomatic roles within the top of the Russian diplomatic system for a very, very long time. I don't think any part of this is typical or normal, to use the word you used. Steve Witkoff is the envoy. Kirill Dmitriev is Vladimir Putin's envoy here. Do you think it's unfortunate that the international system of diplomacy isn't being used more and that it's this kind of one-on-one personal envoy structure?
You did not express your disappointment that the international system of diplomacy was not used for the entire duration of the Biden administration.
No, I was asking you did not
mention that Europeans are really very nervous that they're being marginalized. But I can quote a lot of what Europeans stated. I mentioned already Kaja Kallas and Ursula von der Leyen, who said any deal must make sure that Ukraine is stronger and that Ukraine is on top of Russia. Look, do you need negotiators who believe in this kind of logic and who don't want to look for honest balance of interest? The Trump administration is interested in searching for a balance of interest. They sincerely want to understand better the Russian position, and they're getting this understanding. And we understand better the American position through negotiations and meetings and discussions which we have with them.
In January, Russia signed a deal with Iran to become a strategic partner. Would Russia be willing to sever that relationship at the request of the U.S. if it meant better relations with America?
There was never any request like this. And we welcome the process which was initiated between the United States and Iran. We are ready to be helpful if parties believe this can be the case. And they know this.
You were the negotiator back in 2015 on behalf of Russia for that landmark international agreement, the JCPOA. And part of how Russia was helpful was destroying Iran's enriched nuclear material. Is that an offer you would do again?
We were not involved in destroying Iran's nuclear material.
Disposing.
The part of the deal was move some amount of this material to Russia for keeping.
Okay. So not destroying, but keeping. Would you keep Iran's enriched nuclear material that they've made in the past few years? Is that an offer to the U.S.?
I said, we are not putting our nose in the negotiations between two countries, one of which is not Russia. And I said very clearly, I believe, but you wanted a brief answer, I will have to be longer, since it is not probably getting through. We welcome the dialogue between the U.S. and Iran. We would be certainly ready to help if both parties believe this is going to be useful. And they know that we are ready.
Mm-hmm. Well, back then, there were sanctions and pressure at the U.N. It's a very different dynamic now. I want to ask you quickly about nuclear weapons, because Russia is such a nuclear powerhouse.
Now, from my own perspective, I'm very much interested in this response that he gives, and this is how I feel completely.
According to U.S. intelligence, Russia is developing a new satellite meant to carry a nuclear weapon, which would knock out other satellites and devastate the U.S. if it's used. That's in publicly...
You heard him laugh about that, yes?
...published material. Does Russia intend to violate past treaties and actually put a nuclear weapon in space?
Well, before asking this question, you have to check whether this is true or not, what your military...
This is what U.S. intelligence says.
U.S. intelligence, I was listening to President Trump about his views of what is the list of achievements of U.S. intelligence. And I have my own facts on which I rely. We have been promoting for many years in the United Nations a resolution prohibiting putting any nuclear weapons into outer space. The country which is categorically against it is the United States. At the same time, the United States promotes an approach according to which they want to prohibit putting conventional weapons in outer space. And they cannot answer the question, does this mean that nuclear weapons, they would be planning to move to the orbit? So my answer is very clear. We have been championing in the United Nations a legal prohibition of placing any nuclear weapons in outer space. And the United States, at least during the Biden administration, this was the case. They were categorically against it.
So that'll be the last question that we listen to, but I'm glad we got to it, because I wanted to get specifically to this. We may follow up on it a little bit tomorrow, but I only got a couple minutes left of the show. And this is absolutely true. Russia has been trying to pin down at the United Nations and create a treaty that says there will be no nuclear weapons sent into space. Meanwhile, U.S. intelligence, and I believe this is a false flag BS nonsense, just like everything else that goes on in America that comes from the government, you can, whatever you're going to accuse someone else of doing, you're actually doing. And so what Lavrov is saying is what I've been following for a couple, 3 years now, that at the UN they've been trying to have a resolution in the UN that nobody will put nuclear weapons in space. Meanwhile, the US is focused on, we don't want anybody putting conventional weapons in space. And Lavrov is going, well, if that's the case, then why don't we say no weapons, you know, including nuclear weapons in space? Why don't we add that to the mix? And the U.S. has never come close, is always denying that sort of a resolution. Nobody gets to discuss that kind of a resolution. And so... Lavrov did a very good job in the interview. If you get a chance to listen to it all, perhaps you should. I wanted to let you know that I appreciate each and every one of you being here on the show. and listen to the show. You'll be hearing it, the replay, tomorrow at 4 p.m. in Missouri. And you can listen to my podcasts on damradio.com. You can listen to them on internationalflavor.com. And join me again tomorrow night for the live version at 9 p.m. or for the recorded version at 4. Have a very good evening, and I love having you.